ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Alex Bruzkowski spends a lot of his life around big cats, but he's only been really scared once. On that day in Uganda, Alex was tracking a pride of rare tree climbing lions. He was in his little Suzuki Jeep without proper doors. And as night began to fall, the lions came down from their trees and became very interested in Alex. Alex is a conservation biologist and a wildlife cameraman with National Geographic. He's documented leopards in India, jaguars in the Amazon, and lions in Uganda. And one of the lions there that has a special place in his heart is known as Jacob. And if ever there was a cat who really did have nine lives, it would be Jacob, who survived being poisoned, trapped, snared, and gored by a buffalo. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Sarah. Hi.
You grew up in Africa, on the continent that's home to these amazing mammals, but where were you born?
I was born in a little town in Greece, in Athens, called Attica. My parents were refugees from Poland, and they fled to Greece, and I was born along the small little seaside town, yeah.
Do you have any memories of Greece?
Mainly animal and beach memories, actually. So dolphins and, small cocker spaniels. That's really the only thing I remember, yeah.
So that's where you were when you were born. How did your family end up in South Africa?
Yeah, so they were basically trying to find a way to kind of rebuild their lives after the fall of communism. And in 1993, it was basically a toss-up between either Canada, Australia, and South Africa. And they managed to get a little window to become doctors in South Africa. And that's where they went, yeah.
And so where were you based there?
Johannesburg, first in a little place called Rosettenville, and then later Parkhurst, before moving down to the town of Durban in KwaZulu-Natal, yeah.
Lots of people, Alex, who devote their working lives to animals the way that you do, they're often being drawn to them from a very young age. Like, some of their first memories seem to be about trying to trap reptiles or chase after the family dog. Was that the case with you?
Yeah, so those memories from Greece was actually, it was actually a dolphin that had washed up on the beach. So I don't know if that kind of spoke to me as a little, you know, probably 2 or 3 year old. But then later it was snakes that sort of drew me, working at the Johannesburg Zoo as a volunteer. Yeah, there was always something, either keeping a snake or, you know, there was always some kind of animal link throughout my childhood.
Tell me how you ended up working as a volunteer at the zoo in Johannesburg.
It wasn't a particularly joyful story. I was quite a naughty young boy. It was grade 8 at De La Salle Holy Cross College, and I was very naughty. I got into an altercation with my algebra teacher at that point, and I landed up throwing a ham sandwich. I got expelled, and while my parents were looking for a new school for me, I decided to volunteer at the Johannesburg Zoo.
Ham sandwich. Well, it could have been worse. I thought you were going to say, like, you threw a chair at the algebra teacher. Ham sandwiches. Thankfully, it was a soft landing, I assume. How did your parents react to that? I mean, immigrant doctors, I guess they had pretty high expectations for their son. How were things at home when that happened?
I think they were pretty lousy growing up in terms of sort of my academic performance. I was certainly a late bloomer on the whole science and conservation biology front. It only happened when I left school, and I kind of got into an awkward position because of my inability to get good marks, especially in maths. I wasn't an immediate fit for the zoology program, so I actually couldn't get into university.
So tell me about the volunteering work then, where you had this practical experience with animals at the zoo. What kind of animals did you work with when you were just 12, 13?
Yeah, it was chimpanzees, and then also at the reptile section with a guy called Andrew Pringle. So I was working on snakes, but mostly just chopping up vegetables and fruit for the chimpanzees. Yeah, so it was, for any youngster, those kinds of imprinting memories of being close to animals, especially large primates, are pretty special.
Instead of going straight into university, you went to Game Ranger School, which sounds sort of wildly exciting. What happens at Game Ranger School?
Yeah, so that was at the Southern African Wildlife College. It's still available to anybody who might be listening and who might be interested. It's actually a wildlife campus that's located on the edge of the Kruger National Park in South Africa, our largest and wildest national park in South Africa. And basically, it was about a year long course teaching students from all sort of walks of life on how to track animals, basic biology and conservation, and also even showing guests what to and what not to do around wildlife on safari.
And even as a young guy, teenager still, I guess at that point, 18 or so, was it being out away from other people, away from the cities and suburbs, being in the wild that was part of what was drawing you as well as the animals themselves?
Yeah, I think so. And there's fewer and fewer, wild spaces. And what I mean by wild spaces, I don't necessarily mean where people are not found. There's a lot of places where you find people and wildlife living together across the world. What I mean specifically is this idea of big, fierce animals living with us. So things like elephants, things like, Cape buffalo, African lions, leopards, tigers, whatever they might be, those are becoming rarer. So I think that was the draw card of the Wildlife College, was the ability to live alongside things like elephants.
You did then end up at university, at the Nelson Mandela University. What was your campus like?
Yeah, that's one of the academic sort of gems of South Africa that not many people know about. They know about the University of Cape Town, but they don't know that there's a smaller campus about 300 kilometers east called the Nelson Mandela University School of Natural Resource Management. And what's incredible about this place is it's nestled into the heart of the Cape Fold Mountains and also some of the last temperate forests of South Africa. So you have a campus that's actually also got big animals living on it. So you've got leopards running around there, you've got caracal running around
the actual, like, past the library.
Yeah. So there's a campus section called Fern Tech. It's like where the furniture training, the equivalent of TAFE, takes place. And there's been leopards that have been photographed on camera traps right there.
Amazing. Are they dangerous?
No, not at all. These particular leopards are very interesting because they're about half the size of leopards across the majority of continental Africa. So traditionally, leopards will, sort of males will get up to about 85, 86 kilograms, females maybe 45, 50. These ones are literally half that. So males will seldom get to over 45 kilograms and females maybe 22, 25 kilograms. So these tiny little, diminutive leopards running around the campus.
Yeah. What did you come to appreciate about leopards living so close to them during that time, Alex? What did you learn about them as a species?
Yeah, so at that point, there wasn't a lot of knowledge known specifically about what they are eating there and also some of their interactions with people. And also how many they live. At that point we were basically after every campus class that I would have, I would go out with a little backpack and try and collect the droppings of the leopards, try and find them to see what they were eating. Yeah, so that was one of the things
and
I was doing.
What were they eating?
So in that particular area, because there's forest, they're actually eating bush buck. So it's a medium-sized ungulate that weighs about 45, 50 kilograms. And also, ironically, these small rats called flay rats. They live in the sort of swamp and the grassland areas around the campus. Yeah.
So here you were doing academic work, I guess, starting to research these big cats and other animals of this part of Africa. How did you get a foot in the door first off with National Geographic?
Yeah, so that was really the workings of one man initially called Steve Winter. So he's National Geographic's arguably the premier big cat photographer. He's been working on big cats for over 25 years for the magazine. He's just embarked on his latest Asiatic lion story. And we met in 2012 when I was actually doing my master's fieldwork on leopards in a game reserve called Pinda. And I guided him around for just a week, showed him some of the leopards, showed him some of the wildlife. He was taking photos at the time. And then later, a couple of years later, I needed a job and I was just looking. I was contacting people and I said, hey, you know, have you got anything going on? And he's like, yeah, I'm about to embark on the biggest magazine story on leopards ever done. Do you want to help?
It's great timing, Alex, to get in contact at that point.
Pretty much, yeah.
How did the lifestyle of a National Geographic photographer compare to the lifestyle you'd been living as a student? Did it look like an enjoyable path, an appealing path for you to follow?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I hadn't really done all that much traveling. So that was, I guess, the first thing. You know, the only places I'd traveled to really were Mauritius and England and a couple of places in Europe. So it was all pretty tame in terms of, you know, other than traveling across Africa, I hadn't really been to any places, particularly, you know, South America or also Asia. And that's where we landed up. One of our first stops was India. So we spent about 3 months there documenting everything from leopards living in a city in Mumbai to, you know, man-eaters up in the north of the country along the Himalayas. So that was just a huge eye-opening experience culturally, and also just what on earth these leopards are actually capable of doing. So I'd say that those were the immediate lifestyle eye-openers, yeah.
What did you learn from Steve in terms of photographing and filming these incredible animals?
Yeah, so I guess there's two things. The first is that although Steve would obviously always take incredible images of the leopards or the tigers or the lions that he was that were his subjects, it was really more important seeing him in action, photographing everything around the study subject. So, you know, when we think of a National Geographic story, we think, oh, amazing photographs of lions or leopards. But if you actually look deeper, it's every story has actually got to do with the people or the habitats. So it's everything around the subject. That was the most important thing that I learned from him. And then obviously his camera trapping and his lighting are par excellence compared to nobody else. So those are the things.
What role does chance play in getting a great photograph of an animal in the wild, though? How much is it down to luck?
I'd say 80% luck and 20% knowledge of the species ecology and biology. So with big cats that he focuses on, there's two things. The problem is they occur in most cases at very low densities. So your chances of getting them on a camera trap, very low. The second thing is also they use very specific habitat characteristics, mainly roads and trails. So it's about knowing where to set your camera trap and hoping that the cat happens to be in the neighborhood.
You then began working with these tree-climbing lions, Alex. Where do they live?
So the tree-climbing lions are particularly interesting because there's only really three or four populations in the whole of Africa that have this cultural behavior, and that happens to be in Lake Nakuru in Kenya. It also happens to be in Tanzania's Serengeti National Park, Queen Elizabeth in Uganda, and then also there's a couple of other little places, but those are the main ones. Yeah.
And you call it a cultural behavior because, like, my cat climbs trees. Like, do all big cats, are they all able to climb trees?
They're all able to climb trees, but the cultural element is very interesting because in these populations, almost every lion is doing it. So it's not just seeing a lion once a week up in a tree somewhere. This is every day, usually around 8 or 9 a.m., they climb and they come down at about 6 p.m.
Well, like they're going up and kind of clocking on for work and spending the working day up there.
Exactly, yeah, pretty much.
Incredible. And why, I guess, is the obvious question. Why are lions spending most of the daylight hours in trees?
Yeah, there's sort of three hypotheses that seem to be floating around. The first is that they're trying to escape biting flies. So in a lot of East Africa, there's a fly called a tsetse fly. It's pretty gnarly in terms of its ability to sort of bite you and cause discomfort. So that's the first one. The second is that they are trying to get up there to sort of establish a vantage point and see their prey. And the third one is, which I like, is the getting up high to escape the heat of the day. And if you look at koalas do this. So it's about a degree or two cooler, about 30 feet up in the trees. So when they climb the big fig trees in Ishasha, You know, I resonate with that hypothesis the best. But no one really has evidence at this stage.
If it is to do with temperature, are they more likely to climb in the hotter months, or is it something that happens all year round?
Well, in East Africa, you know, it's the temperature variations along the equator are not very vast. So even in winter, in inverted commas, it's still pretty hot.
It's still worth climbing a tree.
Yeah, the only time they do come down almost immediately is when it rains. And the reason they're coming down when it rains is because the branches get slippery. And then it's really a comedy show, because seeing a cat that weighs 300 or 350 pounds trying to get down and then usually falling out of a tree is pretty comical.
What kind of trees are they climbing?
So in Queen Elizabeth National Park on the Congolese border, it seems to be mainly sort of three species. It's the Ficus sycamoris, which is the river fig, sort of big, thick branched tree with sort of splayed out branches. And that's usually where you get the most incredible pictures. But then there's this crazy, almost cactus-like euphorbia, which is actually one of the most poisonous species on continental Africa, called euphorbia ingens. They also climb that weirdly because they kind of get stuck in the branches. And then there's also one or two acacias that they climb. Yeah.
In terms of that cactus-looking tree, I mean, do the spikes hurt them? Are they irritated by the tree?
Yeah, so there's not really spikes per se. They're almost like little tiny, at some points is like spines, but they're not particularly pronounced. It's really the milky latex. So if you happen to pierce or break the branches of that tree, it's that latex that is incredibly poisonous. It's actually used in some places as a fish poison. Yeah.
And does that affect the lions?
It doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to, because they don't seem to really pierce into the sort of heartwood of the tree. They just seem to sort of get up and then they just sort of position themselves, wedge themselves in between the branches.
And is there more than one lion in a tree?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you can see 8, 9, 10 lions in one of these euphorbias, which is just crazy. Yeah.
You said, Alex, it's a cultural behavior. Why, as a scientist, do you know it's something cultural rather than just something innate that this species does?
Yeah. So I had like a debate with a bunch of lion scientists about this, because recently on the African Lion Working Group sort of email chat, you know, which is a collection of Africa's lion experts, and they were all saying, yeah, lions climb trees in all of our areas. It's nothing new. But I said, yeah, but do they climb this every day? And this is what's very different about these lions, is that they are learning this from the maternal line. So they're learning it from their mothers. And the sisters and the aunts and the little cubs, they're watching their older siblings and nephews doing this. And it's very clear. You can see them picking it up roughly from about 6 weeks of age, following their siblings and their relatives up the tree. It's fascinating.
Is that, how are prides constituted? Like when a cub is that young, is it living with all of the members of its pride, or just its mum and siblings?
Yeah, so for the first sort of 4 to 6 weeks, what the lionesses will do is they'll sort of move away from the pride, and what they'll do is they'll find a safe resting spot, and then they'll have the cubs there, and then she will be guarding them with her whole life, her whole soul, and only after about 4, 5, 6 weeks she'll slowly start introducing those cubs to the rest of the pride. Just because, you know, they're so small and there's new smells. Yeah, and obviously also because of the fact that, you know, there is an infanticide element in lions, you know, and there's paternal uncertainty as to who the father might be.
Explain that to me more.
Yeah, so with lions, about half of all lions under the age of one will actually die because of infanticide. Infanticide, where a male will come and actually kill the progeny of a pride. So if there's potentially a takeover that's taken place and there's a new male in town and a female happened to sire cubs from the previous male, she'll be very wary of that.
When that lioness has moved away with her cubs from the rest of the pride, how is she feeding herself? Does she have to go off and hunt, or is she just subsisting on her existing fat stores?
So she'll still go out and hunt. But a lot of the time, you know, there might be a little bit more of a prolonged period between hunts, and she's obviously suckling, so she still needs to hunt, and she needs to actually produce, you know, a lot more milk and energy for those cubs. So yeah, so she's still hunting, yeah.
And when the lionesses start introducing their cubs into the trees and tree climbing, what have you observed? How do they go about teaching baby lions to climb trees?
Yeah, so it's more of the instinct is coming from the little ones trying to join their mother at the top. You know, and she'll be calling them and sort of edging them on, but a lot of the time they just fall out. But they slowly pick it up, you know, and, you know, a lot of the time the distance that they're climbing is not particularly dramatic. So, you know, those falls are not as, they're not as bad for them as yeah.
What sounds do little cubs make?
Yeah, it's sort of these small, those kinds of sort of small location calls, and they can't really vocalize very, very much at that age. So yeah, that's what they sound like. Yeah.
When they're trying to get up that tree, or maybe falling out. This national park, the Queen Elizabeth National Park in Uganda, how do you travel there as a scientist? What's it like to get to this part of Uganda?
Yeah. So, Kampala, really the sort of the capital, has really got one exit road out, the sort of Kasese Road, and then there's another road, the Mbarara Road. So there's sort of two avenues out of the city, and you sort of can get to the national park in anything from about 8 to 11 hours, depending on which road you take and how good your car is and sort of the general state of the highway along the path, yeah.
And once you're out there in the national park, where are you sleeping?
So for my PhD, I was just sleeping in a number of places, sometimes on my rooftop tent. So it's, you know, it's a little collapsible tent that just lives on my car. In small lodges, so I was staying in a place called Tembo Safari Lodge. I literally had a tiny little room. I think it would cost about $8 a night to stay in with a little bed. And in other times, you're just sleeping in your car. So, yeah.
And what are the sounds like at night?
Yeah, it's really something for the audience to consider. If you ever get a chance to go to Africa and just listen to it at night, it's truly special because of the, I'd say that if there's one animal that really makes it special is the whooping calls of the hyena. That's truly something amazing. And then obviously the lion. If you're fortunate to be living in a place where there are still lions, hearing that roar at night is probably one of the most enigmatic things you'll ever hear in your life.
One lion that you encountered for the first time back in 2018 is a lion known as Jacob. Why did he stand out to you the first time you met him, Alex?
He stood out just because I think initially, you know, we were trying to get interesting behavior on video that people hadn't seen of these lions. And when I say interesting behavior that people hadn't seen, using new technology. And at that point, drones had just come onto the market. So we used a small little Mavic 2. We got special permission from the Uganda Wildlife Authority to be able to use this drone. And he was really the first individual to tolerate this drone.
Really? It didn't bother him?
It didn't bother him. And within a week, he got so used to it that, you know, we could get to within a meter of him with this drone. So we've got this incredible footage, you know, with a 24-millimeter lens of him just chilling in this tree, getting up, you know, and this is, you know, 25 feet up in the air, stretching, just looking at the tree, making a wee out of the tree, you know, like completely relaxed, like the drone wasn't even there. So that was really it was this unique behavior we got to him. You know, we got very intimate with him with this drone. And that's really how he became a central character in our documentary, and then later in a second documentary that we made, yeah.
Who named him Jacob?
Jacob was named by Mustafa Nsibuga, who is, I think, in my view, probably the Ugandan authority on tree-climbing lions. He's worked for every major conservation NGO, you know, the WCS, the Uganda Conservation Foundation. He's now working for the Virunga National Park in the Congo. And he knows those lions better than anyone because he studied them and been around them for more than two decades.
So humans can recognize individual lions, Jacob and his sister Jessica and the rest of them. What about lions? Are they recognizing you opposed to Mustafa, do you think?
I don't think so. I think, you know, generally 99% of lion encounters, you know, lions will look at you in a vehicle as sort of one single entity. If they see a game drive vehicle, they're not going to really pay attention. There are obviously some handful of events. So in Zambia, in Lua Plains, there was once a lioness that developed a very strong relationship with a cameraman because she was the last lioness. And she got so used to a particular cameraman that he could walk alongside her. So she definitely recognized him. But that was a very unique circumstance. It's very rare that you're gonna be able to develop that kind of a bond with an individual animal.
So Jacob, when you first encountered him and had already been known to researchers, what had he survived in his life by this stage, by the time you first met him?
I don't think he'd survived a lot other than he was getting pressured by his dad and his uncle. So there was a coalition of male lions there called Sura, Saleh and Sultan, also named by Mustafa. And they were these big, black-maned, charismatic males, you know, the Romeos of this part of the world, these incredible 250-kilogram male lions, three of them. And they were just these big tanks. And, you know, Jacob was pushing three at that point, which is around the time where those males were not very keen to have him around. So we got a couple of interactions on video where these big male lions are pushing Jacob and he's not liking it, you know.
What was different about that lion the next time you saw him? What had happened to his leg?
Yeah, so we just after COVID, my fiance Anna Chrysal and I got another gig with National Geographic to make a sequel to the documentary that we make called Tree Climbing Lions. And we went at an interesting time because Jacob had just survived a encounter with a wheel trap.
What's a wheel trap?
So a wheel trap is a particularly nasty. It's a device used to actually catch animals and maim them. It's usually used, at least in East Africa, to catch ungulate animals for the bushmeat trade.
What's ungulate?
So an ungulate is any sort of ruminant animal. So a thing like a buffalo. It can be a gazelle. It can be a Uganda cob. So basically, think any animal with horns generally. So obviously those animals are eaten as a protein source in a lot of villages and even a lot of cities and towns, both for commercial and subsistence reasons. But obviously the same areas where these antelope are often walking, the lions are following them to hunt them, and they walk into these traps. And Jacob lost a leg in the process and was saved by members of the Uganda Wildlife Authority, which is the government wing of the Wildlife Department. The Uganda Conservation Foundation, I think the WCS was also involved, and they managed to rescue him.
What, from the trap itself?
From the trap itself, but obviously in the process he actually lost the bottom half of his back left leg. So now he was a maimed three-legged lion, yeah.
And what does that mean? What does that mean for his role in the pride?
Yeah, so, you know, I think, you know, when we arrived, when Anna arrived with me, we were working with another former Uganda Wildlife Authority ranger called Jimmy Kasembo. And we didn't really know what to expect because we thought, oh, well, you know, can we even find this guy? You know, how is he doing? Can he even keep up with the pride? So that was really our mission. And when we got there, we found him a lot of the time alone. But usually at sort of dusk, he would give out this location call. And a location call is this low, like, that's what it sounds like, like this. This low guttural call, and suddenly we saw, you know, six, seven lions come to his side. And at that point, he was living in a pride of lions of 14 individuals. And yeah, he was not only keeping up with them, but even trying to join them on hunts. He was getting involved in altercations with those big male lions that I was talking about. And he was even driving off hyenas around a buffalo carcass. I've got footage of him literally taking on hyenas.
Incredible. How does he move?
With three legs.
How does he do that? I mean, is he limping as he goes?
Yes, he's limping as he goes. And I think he kind of knows, you know, some of the limitation. But I mean, there's footage of him, you know, trying to run, trying to, you know, Jimmy and Mustafa have said that they've seen him hunting cob on those three legs. A lot of the time he'll just join the pride when they've made a kill, but they've seen him hunting.
How far do these lions range? Like, do they move over much territory?
So Jacob himself, he's actually moved 80 kilometers north from the south of the park to a place called Chambura. But historically, he moved from Uganda into the Congo and back. Hmm. So this is the interesting thing about a lot of lion populations in Africa that we don't consider as members of the public and even scientists. These are multi-passport holders. They move across international boundaries, sometimes 2-3 countries at a time. And that makes them quite difficult to conserve and manage because whose lion is it really?
Is he tracked at all, like with a collar or something like that? Or how did you go about finding him when you were there?
Yeah, so he currently has a collar that was fitted by the Uganda Conservation Foundation. But historically, he's had collars from various different institutions. We collared him in 2018. And subsequently, he's been monitored by different people. So, he's monitored on like a daily basis.
So he remarkably was keeping up with his pride, even with three legs. But then what happened to many members of that pride in 2021?
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, the thing is with Jacob, he kind of, you know, when they say cats have got nine lives, he literally has had nine lives. So he survived, before he lost the leg, he survived a snare. A wire snare. So he managed to walk away with just a bit of a maiming, but he was fine. He still had the leg. Then he lost the back leg. Then his pride got poisoned.
And why is that? Why are the lions being poisoned? And
yeah,
by
so
who?
The lions in that particular case were poisoned because of actual targeted body trade for lion parts. So six lions were killed in that poisoning event. Somehow he dodged that. And managed to survive with a couple of his brothers. So that's a problem that we're seeing across a lot of places in Africa. We're seeing it in Mozambique, parts of South Africa, and it's fueled by the demand for lion body parts and the medicinal markets around that.
And then what did he encounter after surviving the two traps and the poisoning?
Yeah. Then he got gored by a buffalo. And he managed to survive that too. Obviously, there was a treatment process that, again, the Uganda Wildlife Authority helped him. But yeah, this guy, if we actually count, he's probably used four of his nine lives that we probably know of.
He should be a Marvel superhero.
Exactly,
like that.
and God knows only what how many close encounters he's had that he's survived. Hmm. So truly a special lion, and probably.
As a wildlife biologist, Alex, you would be seeing animals die all the time. I mean, that's what happens in nature. They're injured, they're gored, they're killed. Mm. Is it different when you see an animal injured or killed by human activity, like the poisoning and the traps?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think that it's something that 95% of scientists working on any charismatic species can relate to. And this is where it becomes kind of interesting territory because the longer you spend studying a particular animal, it can be an elephant, it can be a dingo, it can be a gorilla. There is a certain attachment. We anthropomorphize these things. We start to see personalities, traits, behaviors that we start to sort of say, well, they're so similar to us. But we have to be careful because in a lot of cases, these animals don't have any, we don't have any policy level ownership of them. Like myself, I'm a South African. I'm certainly not a Ugandan. And, for that reason, I don't have any real say as to how those animals should be managed. I can make some scientific studies and sort of help the government, which I'm proud to be doing. But I cannot say anything on who should do what in terms of how these animals should or shouldn't be saved. So that's obviously always in the back of my mind as a foreigner. You know, how do we do this in a way that's not going to upset the local constituency, yeah.
Mm. You've spent a lot of time around these tree-climbing lions and got up close in various ways with your camera and with the drone. Tell me about the one time that you did get genuinely scared. Where were you? What were you doing?
Yeah, I've seen big cats act kind of scary on three occasions. Twice it was with the leopards that charged me, but that was totally warranted because we got too close. But this particular occasion was at the end of 2017. We were just starting the documentary on the tree climbing lions. I was with my really good research assistant, Sam Isoke, And we just found Jacob, Julia, Janet, and so his whole, basically his whole pride. And we were in Ishasha, one of the first days of filming, super excited, but we were in a quite a compromised part of the landscape. So we were on some, like on a kind of hillside, and there was all these termite mounds around us, and the lions were just coming down from this big fig tree.
And what, I remember, what were you in?
Oh, we were in a little Suzuki Jimny. So I don't know if anybody knows that it's one of the smallest 4x4s available on the market. It's a very tiny car.
What kind of doors? What kind of protection do you have on the side?
We had no. That's a really good point. We had no filming. We had a filming door. So my friend Matt Myhill in South Africa basically made like a little iron door, but it wasn't a door. It was basically like something to hold my camera. So I was kind of exposed on this right-hand side.
You're on a motorbike is what it sounds
like. Yeah, essentially.
Almost.
I mean, it's like a tiny little car. And but, you know, all the times that I've spent around big cats, they'd always seen the vehicle and the people in it as one entity, and they'd never shown any interest. So Sam was just like, hey, man, maybe we're too close to these lions. I don't feel comfortable. We should get out of here. And I was like, Sam, come on, man. Like, we're just getting started, dude. We're going to spend the whole night with these things.
We're National Geographic filmmakers. We're not messing around.
Yeah. We're just trying to get some cool behavior and maybe them hunting. And then the one female just did this weird, like, flick tail that I'd seen before, but this was a bit odd. And then she just looked straight into the vehicle. And then Sam said, we shouldn't be this close to the lions. We should get out of here. And then I was like, maybe we should just back up a bit. And then suddenly, as we're backing up the car and we're kind of turning around, don't forget, there's all these termite mounds around us. So we're kind of trying to maneuver around them. We suddenly have two lions on either side of the vehicle. We have Jacob and his sister, Julia, and then Jacqueline and the other lioness on the left-hand side. And they're walking parallel to us, and they're looking into the vehicle. And I sort of start to accelerate, and Sam takes out this big yellow 25-liter empty drum, this jerry can that we have for fuel, and he starts to bang it on the side of the door. And the lions aren't getting discouraged by this big noise. And
how fast was your heart going, Alex?
Yeah, no, I was genuinely terrified. It was the only time that I've seen lions do this, and I don't know if it was because of the size of the vehicle. I don't think so, because I'd filmed lions in the north of the park, and they completely ignored the car, even though I was like a meter away from them after they killed a warthog. So this was one particular pride of lions, certain individuals, and I'd never seen that behavior before or after.
And so you're reversing, and your colleague is banging the side of the car with his gallon drums. The lions are right there. How did you get away?
We just kind of dodged the termite mounds. I managed to get the car in the right direction, slowly drove, and we just made a lot of noise. But the noise was completely, it was like redundant, didn't help. And this is the thing, a lot of people, if you walk into lions on foot in the middle of the day, they're like big pussycats. You can just clap and shout, and they'll run away with their tails between their legs. At night and at dusk, things completely change.
Why?
And they just lose complete fear of humans.
Why? What's happening at night for lions?
I think their eyesight is a lot better, and they because of that, they just grow a lot bolder. So if you read Colonel James Patterson's original Man-Eaters of Tsavo book, you know, at the turn of the century when he's building that big railway, if you look at all the lion attacks, most of those lion attacks are all happening at night. And if you look at even some of Craig Packer's analyses of lion attacks in Tanzania, they almost always happen at night with a moon in the background. People are walking between villages. That's when lions are attacking people. They're not happening in the day.
Did they chase the car once you started accelerating?
They never chased the car, but when we hit the road, we just accelerated and got out of there. Like, it was crazy. Yeah.
Did it change the way you approached filming? Like, did you still film at dusk, or was that a time of day that you thought best not to be so close?
No, we just were very careful with that particular pride of lions. We just didn't film them at night.
Are you armed when you're filming?
No. We generally do always have a Uganda Wildlife Authority ranger in our vehicle. On this particular night, we didn't. But yes, there is always an AK-47 in the vehicle for safety. Not that I don't even know how that would look. We'd probably end up being shot ourselves. Like, that particular car was so small that I don't think, you know, we wouldn't have been able to do anything.
Are lions the most dangerous thing you encounter in filming in those kind of circumstances?
No, not at all. In fact, it's elephants and buffaloes and hippos. Those are actually the animals that I'd say I'm the most wary. So hippos are quite difficult at night. So that little safari lodge where I was staying for $8 a night, Timber Safari Lodge, they actually, the hippos come and graze at night. So if you have to walk between, like they say, the kitchen and where you're sleeping, there's a high likelihood that you'll bump into a hippo. And what a lot of people don't know is hippos kill more animals. They kill more people in Africa than all of the big five combined.
What?
Yeah, yeah. So hippos are quite a gnarly one. And then obviously
what
elephants.
What happens if you bump into a hippo? What's the hippo likely to do?
Oh, man, you just got to run. Like it's not something that you can kind of stand up to. It's like you just got to get away from it. It's slowly get around a wall or something. It's a kind of a dodgy place to be in. Yeah.
Is it going to charge you to eat you or just to destroy
you?
They're
not particularly comfortable being away out of water. So, and you certainly don't want to get between a hippopotamus and water. That's one of the worst things you can do is get between a hippo and where it wants to be. So yeah, and then obviously elephants. Elephants you have to be very careful with, especially on foot. But again, with an elephant, you don't want to run away. You never want to run away with an elephant.
What do you do instead?
You just have to stand up and shout and clap and basically you should generally with a lot of animals in the wild, especially with big cats, you also should not run. You should stand your ground, clap, shout, make yourself as big as possible. Yeah, and ideally, you should always be in a place where the wind is in your favor, so that they can't smell you. So always keep a bearing of the wind direction, and always stay upwind of them, so that they can't smell you. Because that's how all of these animals are invariably reacting to the presence of a human. They're reacting to your smell, and then they're reacting to the fact that you're a bipedal ape with forward-facing eyes. They've evolved to be scared of us. Yeah.
You've been involved in a census, a new census for lions. Why is it important to know how many lions there are? What's the significance of that? Why is that crucial?
I think the honest answer that I have for that is that conservation is a game of giving money. It's not a real game of generating money. So it's chronically underfunded. If you look at Africa, you need about $1 billion. That's what Jennifer Miller, Peter Lindsay, and those colleagues that did that study estimated is what you need if you want to safeguard the last protected areas in Africa with elephants and lions, $1 billion annually.
Wow.
In order to save them, in order to effectively fund anti-poaching forces, fences, and management authorities that are in charge of managing those animals.
Well, that's only a few nuclear submarines.
Yeah, like, exactly, so. Exactly. So imagine that every year, we obviously don't have that. 90% of Africa's protected areas don't have the money to be able to effectively safeguard the populations of charismatic animals that are in them. And for that reason, we want to know, or at least I hope that we want to know, which conservation interventions and projects have the best outcomes for the conservation of animals. So what are the activities that are going to save lions on the ground? And the only way that we know this is by monitoring very intensively and fiercely how lions, tigers, elephants are actually doing.
When you go to count lions, how do you know you're not counting the same lion twice?
Well, this is the thing, is unfortunately, about 50% of studies that have been done in the past historically would have made that mistake. And the way that you avert that mistake is actually by taking high-resolution imagery of their faces, and you can actually look at their whisker spot patterns and the color of their noses.
And what, that's different for every individual lion?
It's different for about 93 to 97% of all lions. So Craig Packer really did the definitive study on this in the Serengeti, and he looked, and there was another group, Penichuk and Radai, they also looked at subsample of lions, and about 97% of all 900 samples that they looked at have different whisker spot patterns.
So is this how you've been doing your census, photographing lions and distinguishing them that way?
Exactly. So that's one component, the individual identity of the animals, but also actually keeping a GPS log of where you're driving. So the biggest thing that we are not doing in most animal counts, whether they be counts of dingoes, whether they be counts of elephants, is we don't factor in where we have looked and where we haven't looked. And the aspect of where we haven't looked is just as important as where we have looked, because then we can actually factor in the animals which we aren't seeing in the population.
Yeah. So I'm imagining this is involving a lot of scientists or researchers spreading out over a great distance to do the counting. How many people have you needed to conduct the census?
Yeah, so that's really an interesting aspect of our work in Uganda and some of the works of our colleagues in Kenya, is that the method is brought together over sort of 20 different entities in Uganda, over 100 different Ugandan and international collaborators have essentially merged forces to survey over 12,000 square kilometers of protected area land. And it's really the demands of the species. It's the fact that these lions move over such big distances. There's no scientific entity or research group or national park authority that could really do this effectively by themselves. We need to work together to cover as much land and to share as much resources because of that underfunding to effectively be able to figure out how many of these things there are out there.
The fact that the tree climbing lions you've spent so much time with spend most of the day sitting around in trees, does that make them an easier group to count than lions that are moving about on land?
It's a very, very good question. And the reason that it's a very good question is because the counting mechanism that we use, one of the parameters is called detection probability. What is the likelihood that you see a lion in a landscape? And as you can imagine, with a lion that's sitting in a tree, you're driving around and suddenly, boom, from 150 meters, you see a tail hanging out of a tree. So for that reason, you are seeing them with a very high likelihood. But that in of itself is this weird, it's kind of like it's deceptive because you're seeing them with such a high frequency. So you think there's a lot, but actually you're seeing the same individual over and over and over again. So you have to dissect those two things away from each other.
And where are you with the results at the moment, Alex? Have you got figures on how many of these, say, tree climbing lions are left in Africa?
We do. So we're about to publish our national census report with the Uganda Wildlife Authority. The count that we did in 2018 showed that there was roughly 72 individuals left in a 2,500 square kilometer area, which is it's a pretty small population. So to give you an idea, 2,500 square kilometers is about the size of the Masai Mara, which is probably the most iconic lion population anywhere in Africa, anywhere on planet Earth. And there you have about 400 lions living at a density of about 17 individuals per 100 square kilometers. This is about an eighth of that. So this is showing you that although this is an incredibly iconic special population that's doing this wonderful behavioral thing that's bringing in a lot of tourists, they're severely threatened.
72 seems tiny. Is that viable? I mean, what do you think the future of these lions is?
So the biggest thing that we need in populations of wildlife, especially wild cats, is we're always interested in the females. The females are really the lifeblood of any population. And the reason the females are so important is because these cats are polygamous. So males will typically cover and have babies with multiple females, maybe three prides, four prides, one big coalition of males. And what's happening in Queen Elizabeth is that there's not a lot of females. In fact, the sex ratio there is about 1-to-1, when really we want to be seeing one male to two or three females. So that's where this population is threatened. The females are getting disproportionately taken out of the system, probably because of those poisoning events and also human-wildlife conflict. There's cattle that's in this park.
And are females more likely to be targeted by humans for some reason?
They are. My hypothesis is that they are disproportionately sensitive to poisoning and conflict because often if a carcass is laced, those females will come onto the carcasses and then you're hitting three or four females. Males might be in another area because don't forget, males are moving over a much larger area to cover home ranges. So typically in Queen Elizabeth, the home ranges of males versus females are about 3-4 times the size of females. So yes, they are disproportionately more sensitive to being targeted.
And what's happened with Jacob, this lion that, as you say, has survived maybe four of its nine close encounters? Do you know what's up with him now? Have you seen him recently?
Yeah, so he's living with his brothers, Taibu, and there's another male there, in pretty much the center of Queen Elizabeth, in a very thick and difficult area to get to called Chambura. So they moved about 80 kilometers south after the poisoning event to try and find females. And now they've got a territory up there, and they're living there, and they're monitored. But yeah, they're just in a very difficult place to get to.
And is your hope that you'll try to get back there to encounter him again?
Yeah, I'm hoping to get back there next month to actually try and sort of finish telling more of his story. And he's an older boy now, so just try and tell more about what he's been through as a sort of icon for the species here.
Mm. You, of course, are in Australia now. Is there any of this learning in terms of wildlife that you're applying to the native species around you in this country?
Yeah, so my postdoc is going to have a strong dingo element to it. And obviously dingoes are very divisive in the country because a lot of people don't even recognize them as being a particularly important ecological variable in the ecosystem. But there's obviously also a lot of conflict between different research groups and then obviously the farming community. So my hypothesis is that the monitoring of the species on different lands, whether it's on cattle land, indigenous land, in national parks, that in of itself could potentially bring some of these groups together, is to try and figure out, you know, how are these populations of dingoes doing, or wild dogs, if you'll call them, in these different areas, and for a variety of different reasons.
Alex, I think it's actually been in the best interests of science and wildlife conservation that you ended up getting expelled and spending that time in Joburg Zoo and led to your life here with us. Thank you so much for sharing some of your research.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
I spoke with Alex Brazkowski in 2023. This episode was produced by Maggie Morris, and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.